listening to the Nerds Assemble podcast.
Welcome to episode 270 of the Nerds Assemble podcast. I'm Emily.
I'm Paul.
And I'm Paul, aka Retroid.
Because this is our first regular episode since the Gish episode. So it's a massive catch-up episode. It's like 2 months of catch-up?
Yeah, it's basically been a rocky couple of months.
Internet connections are fickle things. Plus, really late shifts are also fickle things, aren't they? Yeah.
Fortunately, the world is not on fire anymore. Oh.
Wait.
Yeah, shit. Mm.
Did that actually officially stop?
I asked a friend who lives in California, and she said the air quality's improved a bit, but it's not stopped.
My wife has friends in Canada who said that they were, like, coughing in the street.
Yeah.
It's just... nice apocalyptic. Yeah. Is 2020.
I have to admit, I mean, in terms of apocalypses, 2020 is kind of the dullest one, I would say.
It's the most annoying one.
Yeah. Well,
I think when the apocalypse finally arrives, everyone will just be going, oh, it's you.
Yeah.
You know? Come in.
Yeah.
Please get it over with.
Yeah, I can imagine that. But
it's a massive asteroid with nuclear missiles and dinosaurs that have a plague. Okay.
All I know is it's been the kind of apocalypse where I've managed to write more than a novel's worth of fanfic, and what I really should be doing is trying to write an actual novel, which is what I'm going to try and do in November for NaNoWriMo. I'm going to try NaNoWriMo again and actually write some original fiction. I have an idea. I need to outline it in the next, you know, month before November.
If you're doing that in November, you'll either be kind of relieved or really in a funk, depending on what happens in America.
That's true. Well, it'll be partway through. I mean, it's a horror story anyway that I'm working on. The supernatural horror, so like... It's not like I'm writing anything that's going to be super cheerful. In fact, there's going to be some really depressing shit in it and lots of death. So like...
You know what the weirdest part about this year is?
So it's escapism then?
Yes!
But you know what the weirdest part about this year is? Is basically that if somehow Trump got voted out, and if somehow we got a working vaccine that was up and running, basically, the world would be kind of put back to slightly worse than what 2016 was. After those two brilliant, amazing, world-changing things would be almost at the level of 2016.
We still got to do a Brexit. Yeah. Anyway, this is not a political podcast that we have an eye to these.
At hand, and I really wish I did now.
Paul's drinking cloudy cider beside me, and I'm drinking cream soda. As ever, I can be bribed with cream soda, especially it's filled with sugar cream soda, just saying.
Are you trying to get sponsored or something?
I don't know, a cream soda company sponsoring would actually be pretty cool.
Yeah, but then we'd have to go through the process of
make real cherry soda, or like... root beer, though, I've got to be careful about caffeine, so maybe cherry soda and root beer aren't great.
I think nothing refreshes the taste buds and relaxes the mind like a cool Duff.
But we are not sellouts. We have nothing to sell.
We will be for a price. Name your price, we'll discuss it.
Okay, so... it's what we've been up to episode. There is a lot to catch up on, but due to the immense list of my own personal things to catch up on, I'm letting the other guys go before me this time. So, Retroid, what you been up to all the long line, long, long day of hells that the Eternal March? What you been up to?
You mean apart from going fetal and growing?
Apart from that.
Okay. When I've not been doing that, I've mostly been fiddling about with, still fiddling about with arcade PCBs, of which I have had some success, which is nice. I've got a little bit of game history, which I had no idea about when I got this particular game. Right. You might have heard of a tiny little game called Street Fighter 2.
I might have.
Yeah, some people played it. It seemed to be a little bit popular in, you know, one or two corners of the world, like the four of them. Well, Capcom, you know, had a bit of a hit on their hands. The one-on-one fighter was the going thing for a good few years. So, you know, Capcom, you know, quite a big company. And then there was another arcade company, which also did, you know, sort of home games as well, but it was mostly arcade, called Data East. And they did, you know, they had some successes on the NES and, you know, all that kind of thing. They did one of the first one-on-one fighter games in the early mid-80s called Karate Champ, which one of my local chippies had, which was cool. And it was 10 pence a go, so that was fantastic on the way home from school. But, of course, with Street Fighter 2 being such a massive roaring success, suddenly everyone thought, hang on, we want a slice of that pie, which, of course, is a thing that never happens ever again in the games industry. When one company has a runaway smash hit with a genre. So Data East decided to do their own, you know, revisit the genre that they effectively, you know, helped, you know, create in the first place. And they made a game called Fighter's History, which I frankly hadn't heard of until I got a bootleg of in one of my collections of, you know, cheapy arcade boards. And I saw an official board crop up on eBay, and the bloke was, sound doesn't work, selling this as parts or, you know, spares, repairs. You know, take your pick. And I thought, well, if it's an original board, I might as well, because, you know, starting price of 20 quid with, you know, £10 postage, I thought, well, that's quite reasonable for an original. So I plunked a minimum bid on it, won it, which was nice. It arrived, plugged it into my cabinet, and it seemed to be doing a self-diagnostic thing, which I thought was a little bit weird, but it was late at night, you know, switched the machine off, you know, next day, turned it on, and it nearly blasted my eardrums.
So the sound was fine.
The sound was fine, but it seemed to be like, because it had a weird, most arcade boards have a little like volume control on the actual board. Right. And you just, you know, you turn that with a little screwdriver and it'll be, you know, quiet or loud. This was a rare one in that it seemed to be software controlled. It had a button. It had a little button on the, you know, on the board itself that if you pressed, you would go into the menu and you could set a volume and game difficulty, how many credits you would get, you know, blah, blah, blah. That's another thing. Most people don't realize that arcade games had difficulty levels. So you could play it at one arcade and be really easy, and you could play it in another and it would kick your ass. And that would be because the, you know, the person who set the cabinet up wanted you to put more money in.
Mm.
But anyway, yeah. So, you know, basically, short version, it worked. I turned the volume down so my eardrums forgave me. It seemed to be like a CMOS battery thing, because there were a few components that were loose that I've now, you know, since fixed on the board, and now it consistently comes on, you know, like mid volume, it's fine. But I looked up this game, Fighter's History, and it turned out to be a massive test case in the games and arcade industry, where Capcom took Data East 2 court saying that it was a clear violation of Street Fighter 2 look and feel. And I had no idea about this. So I read up about it, and Capcom said, you know, this is far too similar because you've, you know, if you're defeated, well, you know, you've got, you know, special moves, you know, like fireballs, but they're not fireballs. You have various stages around the world. If you're defeated, you get, you know, like a, you know, provocation screen, you know, a little taunt screen where it would be, you know, you need to go back to training, you know, little girl, you know, that kind of thing. And yeah, Capcom seemed to think they had a case. The court disagreed. So it seems to be down to this game and this court case that there was the sudden explosion of one-on-one fighters, which were, you know, very clear in Street Fighter 2 likes.
Wow.
And it was just, I didn't know this happened. I kind of, you know, presumed it might, but yeah, I didn't know it was this particular game. But yeah, I have a bootleg board and I have the original Data East board. And it seems all right. It's a one-on-one fighter. It's not my favourite genre. But yeah, it's perfectly fine. Let's see, other things I've been doing. I've managed to progress in getting arcade games to successfully display on my old CRT TVs. I'm not exactly sure what was going wrong before, but I think I've worked out levels. And also, I think one of the issues was that my oscilloscope seems to be on its way out.
Ooh.
Yeah, which is a bit of a bugger, because I was checking voltages. My oscilloscope was insistent that the signals from these arcade boards were in about 50 volt, which is just mad. But you know, it didn't make much sense to me, but it was there in the oscilloscope, and the oscilloscope works for other signals, but for some reason it seems to be having a bit of a moment when it comes to TV sync signals. So yeah, I measured it with my multimeter and I was getting about 4.2 volts, which is, you know, much more sensible. And it's like, okay, so that's another thing I'm going to have to fix. That's awesome. Another thing I have to afford. Let's see, other things. We have been watching a fair bit of TV. We've been catching up with some things that have either finished or, you know, we just stumbled across.
Like what?
Let's see. We've been watching several series. We've been watching season 4 of Van Helsing on Netflix, which I still think is a... it tries hard to be more than it is, which is a sci-fi series about vampires inspired by, quote-unquote, a graphic novel under the same name. I've talked about Van Helsing before, but they seem to have mixed up a little bit more now that they have some daughters of Van Helsing. The short story is with the Van Helsings, they are the, you know, vampire fighters of, you know, of old.
Hmm.
But this particular generation, or rather now two generations, they have been genetically fiddled with as part of a doomsday plot. There was a volcano super eruption at the start of the first, you know, series, which basically introduced the, you know, the 30 days of night idea, where the vampires were just waiting, and this super eruption, you know, shielded them from the sun for at least months, if not years, because most of the series takes place in, like, years after this happened. And the vampires bring around the end of the world, more or less, because they just, well, there's nothing to stop them from feeding on humans, so they decide, well, you know, we've been around for centuries, screw you guys, it's our turn now. But the Van Helsings have something in their blood which, if one of them is bitten, it will revert the vampire. So you and the resulting ex-vampire has the super healing of vampires, but they are no longer vampiric. So you get someone who's, you know, quite a big bad guy in the first season. And then for the next three seasons, he's very repentant. Because he was an absolute bastard. But of course, that's because he was turned. So now he's kind of, you know, he's trying to make it up to Vanessa Van Helsing and, you know, anyone else that he comes across. This season had quite a good standalone episode, which was a flashback, which took place during the vampire apocalypse. And it was just a group of teenage girls who were part of, an archery competition. And they arrive at the hotel more or less just as, you know, everything is kicking off. So it's them surviving and slowly being picked off. And it's just, frankly, I would prefer more of this episode because, you know, this episode was quite good and it was a nice, refreshing change. I like watching series where they're taking place during the apocalypse and not so much years after. You know, I like both, but it's like, can we have more of the during, please? Because that's, you know, that's a good stage for it to happen. Let's see. So we've watched Van Helsing. That's got one more season to pop up on Netflix. That has apparently been on Sci-Fi in the US, but hasn't been here. So we'll see. Oh, and Trisha Helfer of Battlestar Galactica, you know, pops up in it, and she's the almost Dracula. But she's the, you know, the source of vampirism, which is, you know, sealed away in a like an alternate dimension. And it's basically it sounds like a Sci-Fi Channel series, doesn't it? If you know what
I
mean.
Yeah.
But it tries to do more with it. So it's got a lot of what would vampires do if they, you know, if they could do this and if they won. And what would the people have to do? You know, all that kind of thing. So it's very much B-movie stuff, but it's enjoyable. Other things we've been watching, an Apple TV series called For All Mankind. Have you heard of this?
I mean, we have been keeping away from Apple TV, so we're not that aware of what they've got exclusives for.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because it's Apple TV.
Yeah.
But We've watched it, thanks to a friend.
Called Dave.
Yeah, good old Dave. He's a good chummy's Dave. And it's actually quite good. It's Ronald D. Moore is one of the minds behind it. He of Star Trek, Voyager, and some of Next Gen, and also Battlestar Galactica. And the entire idea behind it is that it is alternate history space program, space race. In the first episode, there's a bit of a shock for NASA when the Soviet Union lands on the moon. Oh. So you have the, you know, well, it starts off with, you know, the sort of, you know, typical era news anchor saying, you know, the lander is now approaching the lunar surface and we're waiting, you know, for the emergence and, you know, who will be the first man on the moon. And you see someone in a spacesuit come down and they plant the hammer and sickle flag. And they make a little, you know, pronouncement in Russian. And it's just, ooh, this is interesting. And as we all know, unfortunately, with the original space race, once America made it to the moon first and landed astronauts there, the Soviet Union just basically packed up its toys and, you know, fine, you can have the moon. But, of course, it's a whole different thing now because, you know, the Soviet Union beats them just by, I think, a matter of weeks. So suddenly they're under pressure to get you know, their lunar landing. And of course, when it happens, it doesn't go quite right. As a space nerd, I know that, you know, the first landing very nearly didn't happen. They were running out of fuel on the you know, the Eagle has landed. And they go a little bit further with that in this one, because of course they're, you know, they're under pressure to perform the landing to, you know, prove that they can do it too. But then they have a second, you know, the Soviets have a second landing where it's the first woman on the moon. And they're all, oh God, this, you know, this is just, you know, looking really bad for us. We desperately need to get female astronauts and have them on, you know, as part of this, you know, program. So, you know, there's all that, which again, it nearly happened. It was kind of happening with the Mercury program, which was, you know, before Apollo and Gemini, I think, when it comes to Gemini. But, yeah, it didn't align in, you know, actual events. So they, you know, they follow that with some of the astronauts that, you know, would have got the training. And then there's more and more, you know, Apollo missions, and there's things like they discover ice on the moon. So they go looking for ice, and then there's a lunar base that they set up. So it's all this. These are things that would have happened in, say, you know, the early mid 70s, if the Apollo program hadn't been just, well, you know, it's, you know, people aren't watching it on TV anymore, and people don't care, and the Soviet Union isn't, you know, bothering. At least in this one, they are. So it's kind of a, it's cool for a space nerd, for me, like, you know, like me. all these things that we could have had, but just didn't bother. It's like when Kennedy did the, you know, we will go to the moon and the other things speech. The technology didn't exist, and the only reason that we managed the moon landing was because they had the whole competition with the, you know, we have to beat the Soviets. So, yeah. I'm looking forward to what they do in season two. Because now, you know, they have a moon base, even though it is a small moon base, and of course it barely works, and they've got a VCR with about six, you know, cassettes. You know, that kind of thing. Yeah. And the role would, you know, you've got three astronauts who are stuck in this place, and they're word perfect on, like, various episodes of, you know, TV shows, because that's all they have to watch.
Yeah.
And things go wrong, like a rocket explodes, so, you know, they're stranded on the moon, you know, for longer, while there's a whole investigation into what went wrong with it. And it's also an alternate timeline, because you end up with a Teddy Kennedy as president. Because it's mentioned in one of them that there's something that stops him from going on a road trip. And, you know, for anyone who's familiar with American history, there was an infamous crash that Teddy Kennedy was involved in.
Yeah.
Where a woman died, and that basically ended his, you know, presidential ambitions. Whereas in this timeline, because he didn't go on this road trip, that didn't happen. He became president.
See, that's one of the things I love about, like, alternate history kind of stuff, is just how, you know, small events can just ripple out and kind of create massive differences.
Yeah. One thing that's quite interesting is the series skips ahead, because it ends about, you know, mid-70s, and then you just have a, you know, post-credits bit right at the end of the episode where it skips ahead to about 1983 or 84. And they have a rocket that launches out of the ocean, which I remember reading that there were plans for. You know, there are all, you know, various, you know, space program plans which never happened, because it suddenly became, you know, there's no political will, you're not getting the funding.
Mm.
And there's no space shuttle. Part of the space shuttle was that they wanted a reusable vehicle.
Yeah.
And it was developed in the 70s, and it had a, you know, very long, protracted development, and it was really expensive. And that's effectively why, you know, you were lumbered with the space shuttle for in about 30 years. Because it was, you know, over-engineered, and you couldn't get high orbits. That's why, you know, there was the International Space Station, because it could reach that orbit, but it couldn't go further than that.
Mm.
And, yeah, everything was about the, you know, the shuttle. So it's kind of, I'm looking forward to seeing what they're doing with that, what they're going to do with the second season, because it's, yeah, it's very nerdy, speculative, what they could have done but didn't. And I get the feeling that they have, they, you know, they've got people who were writing, you know, real nerds, you know, real, like, you know, space program nerds who know all these things that were planned but just didn't happen, and they're trying to sort of weave it in with what did or what was possible.
Mm.
So I'm looking forward to that. And the last thing I will, well, I'll mention two last things. One was a South Korean zombie movie that turned up on Netflix a few weeks ago called Hashtag Alive. And
I feel like I saw some chatter about that. Is it good?
It's good. It's a bloke who, you know, has just played, you know, like video games in his flat, and, you know, his family are away, and then there's a bit of a health scare. You know, that's a little bit weird. And then, of course, it turns out that, yeah, it's a zombie outbreak. So he barricades himself in his apartment. And for the longest time, he thinks he's the only one who's alive. So, you know, posting on, in a social media, hashtag alive. And, you know, trying to ration his food. And then, you know, people trying to break in. And then zombies trying to break in. And they are the nicely terrifying, you know, South Korean kind of, you know, Train to Belson or Busan, Train to Busan. Have you seen that?
No, but yeah. Want to, but yeah.
Yeah. It's good. There's that we also saw a sequel, but it's quite different. I will leave it at that.
Okay.
And yeah, the final thing we've been watching.
Okay.
Is Aggretsuko.
Hey, we still need to watch. Is it season 2 or 3 we need to watch? What's the latest season? Is it 3 seasons or 2 seasons?
3.
So, yeah, so season 3 we need to watch.
So, what did you think of it?
We love it. We did start watching it during a certain part in my career where the office environment depicted in that was perhaps very similar to my own. I am thankfully no longer in such a working situation. Thank fucking God. But Aggretsuko, like I deeply feel what she deals with as somebody who's been told to smile at work.
Jesus Christ.
And like dress more feminine and shit. Like seriously, like fucking to my very core, and as also somebody who likes karaoke and metal, to my fucking core.
Oh God, yeah.
I am a red panda. Red pandas are also one of my favourite animals. I am that character, just the English equivalent.
I mean, red pandas are just awesome anyway, so yeah, it's a winner there. Right, for anyone listening who doesn't know what Aggretsuko is, it's an anime, and it's the basic premise is Aggretsuko is just an office lady, or OL, as they say in Japan, where she works in an accounting department, and she tries to be, as she says, a good girl, a good job, be nice to everyone. Just pack all the resentment and stress down. And then she releases it at karaoke.
Yes.
With death metal.
Yes.
And I we watched a few episodes and we were just absolutely hooked because it's just, yeah, she's just, yes, of course I'll do this. And she puts up with her boss being an absolute bastard and just talking about golf and, you know, short timer and, you know, things like that.
Mm.
And yeah, she just lets it all out. And it's, yeah, it's just an excellent little series. Each episode is only about 15 minutes long.
Yeah, something like that. It's sort of, I think it's a similar length episode to like what happened with like Azumanga Daioh. It's because it's kind of on the comedy side.
Yeah. So it's I mean that was a long tradition in a lot of anime, especially ones that would go on TV. They would be split into like two small, you know, smaller stories per episode. So that was a, you know, a common thing. But of course, with this being on Netflix, I'm not sure if it's Netflix native, if you know what I mean.
I do feel like they've got a hand in it. I mean, the one thing you haven't mentioned so far is that it's from the same people that created Hello Kitty.
That is so weird, isn't it?
Yeah. Like they, I think from what I can remember, they wanted something that would obviously appeal to an older market. And
yeah,
that they achieved that.
I think they did. So you've watched, was it two, is it season two you've watched?
Yeah, we've watched to the end of season two. We started season three, but we would have watched more of it at New Year's. However, terrible things happened to me on New Year's Eve and we had to cut our plans short.
And as we keep on saying, that was kind of almost like a sign of the year to come.
How ill I was. It was so bad, man.
Yeah, it was so, so very bad.
So very bad.
See, and you probably said, at least this new year will be better. And there was a monkey paw. My finger just curled.
It does feel like that sometimes, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's just, I mean, she's trying, you know, she hits a job, she's trying to find a way out.
Yeah.
And for a while she thinks, oh, maybe marriage.
Yeah.
Because if I find a good husband, then I can, you know, quit my job and, you know, do something else. Because, you know, she's barely keeping her head above the water.
Yeah.
And yeah, is that her first boyfriend in the series?
Oh God, yeah.
The other red panda.
Mm.
It's just a personality void, and there was just so much being projected onto him.
I think it's...
my favorite being the the adorable, cute way he sniffs his fingers.
Oh God, yeah.
Yeah.
I think what's interesting about Agretsuko's experience, I mean, yeah, okay, so I saw some commonalities with my own being on the other side of the world, but, like, from what I've read of what it's like to be a Japanese woman these days, who's, like, obviously, you know, trying to have a career, trying to make her way in life, and not deal with, like, social pressures from, like, your parents and stuff, because obviously, like, a lot of families, like, depending on the age of the parents, still quite traditionalist, and obviously, you know, want their daughters to marry, and blah, 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 and basically not have a life, but, like, Japan's, you know, culturally at the moment, it's got, like, massively low birth rates, because, like, a lot of younger women are just like, why the fuck would I marry the men that surround me, and part of it culturally, yeah, it looks like,
you know, why would I marry them? I've met them.
Yeah, like culturally, there does seem to be a massive issue with that at the moment. Or obviously, they're actually only interested in like just satisfying themselves, so like, you know, one night stands or just short term relationships and stuff, or fuck buddies. Yeah. You know, because that like a degree of liberation has happened. Admittedly, you wouldn't think sometimes that a degree of liberation has happened for women in Japan when we consider that was in the past 10 years, the click canoe or kayak or whatever case.
Which is that?
There was a Japanese lady artist who made a, I think it was a like a canoe type thing that was like a massive representation of her vaginal area. Like it was like her labia, clit and stuff. And went paddling around on it, and that was deemed offensive, and she did at least get fined for it and told not to do it. But considering that Japan's also the same country that has, like, festivals with, like, giant penises being paraded around between, like, shrines and shit, it's a bit double standard.
I mean, I like Japan in a lot of ways, but it's massively contradictory. You've got a lot of pull in all kinds of different directions.
But this is what I'm saying, is like Igretsuko like does a really good take, I feel, of like kind of like that female experience and like trying to, because she has to deal with so much freaking sexism in that show. It's insane.
Yeah. And but, of course it's the Japanese culture of not wanting to rock the boat as well.
Yeah.
To be seen as a good employee.
I mean, Brits don't like to rock the boat, but it's not necessarily because we want to be seen as a good employee.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's kind of similar, but not.
Yeah. Okay, if that's your last one, I'm going to ask Paul, what have you been up to?
What have I been up to?
Yeah.
Is it capers or shenanigans?
You've been doing more D&D plotting, haven't you?
Yep, more D&D plotting. So, I mean, kind of not much to really say there, apart from the fact that, you know, the world is still kind of being built and kind of is evolving and kind of players are kind of developing more complex, you know, kind of stuff with it. And I've been kind of helping to kind of build more systems. And yeah, it's basically just kind of evolving, I suppose. But I mean that's kind of what you have to do when you're kind of a DM and you're trying to build like an entire world and still have players have agency. You know, it's something that you've got to do. I've also picked up recently the Super Mario 3D All-Stars thing. So I kind of played through Mario 64 on that, and this might be a controversial opinion, but Mario 64 kind of doesn't hold up to modern 3D platforming standards.
Yes. I've been repressing, I've been holding back.
But I mean, there's certain things that it kind of does well, like, you know, having kind of a nice move set based on, you know, kind of certain things. Although I do have to say that the button presses for the long jump versus the ground pound is just like, no, it could do better, but one of the most frustrating aspects of the game is the camera.
Yeah.
And I kind of understand that, you know, it's basically because it's like one of the first 3D, proper 3D platform games. So they kind of had to build up from scratch, I suppose, in a way. But yeah, it's at times it feels like you're fighting the controls.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's where,
I felt that the first time around.
And sometimes that's where the difficulty comes from. Like, you know, kind of beforehand, where I think when I, you know, originally was playing it, I was far more like thinking like, oh, this is kind of an issue with like 3D aspect of, you know, platforming, but I kind of get through it and whatnot. But now it feels, I suppose because, you know, things have got more refined in terms of like the controls and whatnot of more modern.
And the camera.
Yeah. And of the more modern games, it just really feels like, it kind of reminds me of, you know, that War of the Worlds game that was on Xbox, with the kind of 2D, kind of side-scrolly platformy type thing. And how the latency of the controls were part of the difficulty. It kind of felt a bit like that, where you basically, you'd have a much easier time if the controls were better.
Yeah.
And it's just, yeah. A little bit frustrating.
It's something I've struggled with because, of course, you have people who will constantly bang on about how Nintendo are perfect in everything they do. And I know a lot of people that have got very good memories of Mario 64, but I completed it when I got my N64, but I don't regard it as a classic platformer. And I think Rare did much better than Super Mario 64. I think both Banjo-Kazooie games and Donkey Kong 64 are far better.
I'd never actually got around to playing Donkey Kong 64. I think...
That's it, I'm revoking your card.
I played Banjo-Kazooie, and I did really enjoy that, actually. But I haven't kind of played it recently. And
see that, yeah, that's the
thing. I mean, I've also played Conker's Bad Fur Day. I've played that a couple of times.
Yeah.
The
N64 version?
N64 version.
I'm still annoyed that for Rare Retro Replay on the Xbox One, it's the N64 version that they included. Because I think they did such a good job at upgrading and rejigging slightly the game for their Xbox release, for the Conker, I think it's Live and Reloaded. It was just a shame not to see that. Because it still looks good. It's got fur effects on the original Xbox. And it's backwards compatible on the Xbox One as well. So that's a cool thing. If you can get hold of a copy. I've got one because I bought it, when it was released. But yeah, it's just... Conker is good, even though it definitely went for the playground, humour.
Yeah.
Too much, but...
I think to a certain extent...
Yeah, there's the argument that Super Mario 64 did it first-ish. But, yeah.
But I think, because from what I remember, Conker's Bad Fur Day also had some... sort of camera issues
well. It had camera issues because it was on the N64 and the N64 didn't have a second analog stick. So it was kind of, yeah, if you were going to do something that was third person.
Yeah. Nowadays, because you do have an analog stick, or secondary analog stick as it were, the camera movement, you can kind of adjust it far more kind of smoothly, rather than like Mario 64, where you're kind of almost pressing like the C buttons and it just kind of zipping about, like, I don't know, maybe 20 degrees or so at a time. And it's just like, no, I want to get this one exact angle so it can line up this thing. And no. Or it doesn't make sense in the fact that basically, despite the fact that there's kind of plenty of room behind the character or whatnot, the camera will not go past a certain point. And it's just like, come
all
on.
All I know is that this weekend there was a lot of swearing beside me whilst he was playing. It was a lot.
Yeah, that sounds like Super Mario 64.
But you completed like a playthrough.
Yeah, I completed the playthrough, but I didn't bother with 120 stars.
Because you were going to go crazy.
Yeah, and because basically some of it's tedious. Like, I think you have to actually go into each of the courses and collect 100 coins in each course, and it's just like, I'm not sure I can be bothered to really do that.
Yeah, yeah. Any game that requires you to do that, from Super Mario 64 to the first few Assassin's Creed games, to, I think, was it Metroid 2? I was playing through Metroid 2 on Wii because I got the Metroid Prime trilogy.
Oh, right, Metroid Prime Echoes.
Yes.
Okay.
And it got to a point where you have to hunt down these invisible things.
Yeah.
And it's just, you have to use a special visor. And I just got to a point that I can't be arsed with this. And I just stopped. And because it's just, you have to go through all the environments scanning around. And then switch to a visor and then look around and then jump to another location in the same room and look around. And it's just...
It kind of reminds me of, I'm pretty sure that there's a quest in the original version of Wind Waker, where it's like you have to go searching for pieces of the Triforce. And I think they updated it when they re-released it for the Wii U, where I can't remember whether they meant to basically provide a map or have some way of kind of streamlining it so that you're not basically just kind of going in virtually blind.
Yeah, it's like, okay, this was stupid first time. Let's actually just fix it a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anything else?
Anything else? Let's see. Well, I'm not sure whether you're going to mention it later. Let's see. Enola
Holmes? No, so you can put it on your list.
Okay.
Enola Holmes.
Yeah, which is actually really, really good.
So this is on Netflix.
Yeah.
Whole bunch of famous faces.
Yeah.
I can't remember anyone's name other than the not main characters.
Yeah, you've got, was it Millie? I'll say Millie Parker, but I'm not sure.
Millie something playing Enola?
Yes. Okay. Basically, Millie the girl out of Stranger Things.
It's Millie Bobby Brown.
Millie Bobby Brown. That's one.
Yeah.
MBB. Okay. Then you've got Helen Bonner Carter. And you've got Henry Cavill. You also have Bern Gorman. You have a couple of other kind of famous faces around as well.
But it's based on a book, but it basically is about Sherlock Holmes and Mycroft Holmes' little sister Enola and shenanigans, much shenanigans.
I mean, shenanigans of kind of a serious historical nature as well. I'm not sure how much I should go into.
Don't go into too much because it is pretty new.
That's true. But, yeah, kind of a certain kind of period of history, and it kind of paints Mycroft as kind of a more of an asshole than previous iterations of Sherlock's that we've seen recently. And Sherlock Holmes, well, I mean, Sherlock Holmes has always kind of been a bit of a dick. In all of its iterations, it seems, and he's kind of half dick, half sympathetic. He's a sympathetic dick.
Isn't he kind of blamed? I'm not sure how fair it is in the breadth of literature, but he's kind of blamed as the arsehole genius. Origin.
Yeah. I mean, there is certainly an element to it. I mean, I've not actually read the original Sherlock Holmes novel, so I can't say for how accurate it is for its original, kind of stories and whatnot. But definitely over the past, I'd say probably about 20 years, we've seen more and more brilliant assholes kind of tropes going on from between House and whatnot.
Elementary,
the various different versions of Sherlock.
Even the mentalist. Is it Jane?
Yes.
Yeah, he's not. Well, he. It depends on his mood and how he perceives you as to whether or not he's an ass.
Not to mention, obviously, Rick from Rick and Morty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Neil Holmes. What about The Boys season 2?
Oh yes, we've been watching The Boys
season 2.
Season 2. It's very good. It's kind of almost like an alternate, half superhero world, half our world, in the sense of basically superheroes aren't as clear cut and they're far more of a marketing gimmick than, they are actually going out and helping people.
It is based off of a comic book series of the same name.
And it is at times incredibly brutal.
Yep.
Basically, kind of like Justice League, if it was more realistic, I suppose, in certain respects.
I've still struggled with the first. I mean, because like the comic book series is pretty freaking brutal.
Mm.
Anyway, I'm still struggling with the fact that Eric Kripke, he's the guy that created Supernatural, is like the brains behind the adaptation. Like, because it's very, Supernatural, and even in the early seasons, has like some weird stuff kind of like going on, but like the TV series is so it's very different to Supernatural in terms of the
yeah.
writing.
Yeah.
There's nobody's nobody comes out well in it at all.
Yeah, it's basically because you do get quite a few series where there's like virtually no redeemable characters in there, and they kind of don't work because you're kind of rooting against everybody for basically being just dicks to each other. But in this feels like there's more to it. You know, even though like most of the superheroes are dicks, they're kind of dicks in such a way that you're rooting against them more than you're rooting against other people.
It's kind of the way I look at it. It's because you had so much of the superhero comics being very, not so much in a massively, you know, patriotic, but very idealistic.
Mm.
And then they would fall into their own what's kind of world acceptance. You know, they would just, you know, do things unquestioningly. And seeing as Garth Ennis, who's the, you know, the original writer,
yeah, of the comics, of
the, you know, the comics,
yeah,
amongst other things. I grew up reading his stuff in 2000 AD.
Mm.
So I just had to look him up because I knew he was. You know, he had, you know, an Irish connection, but I wasn't exactly sure whether he was Republic or not, and I didn't want to say Brit because I don't want to go down that path.
Yeah.
But yeah, he was born in Northern Ireland, and he did lots of stuff for 2000 AD before you know, going to Vertigo, and it kind of strikes me as a very sort of cynically British outside view of the genre.
I can kind of see that, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of, you know, these are the superheroes, and it's like these are the kinds of things that would probably happen in the real world if these superheroes inhabited a real world and were more like people rather than these paragons.
I mean, it takes things further in some ways than Watchmen, because everyone who's a soup in The Boys does have powers, whereas obviously in Watchmen, it's more vigilantes with mostly either martial arts skills, some modicum of intelligence, and the only person that's really super powered is obviously like Doc Manhattan.
Who's so super powered that is like...
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, it's kind of coming at it from the, well, all these superheroes are vigilantes because they're not, you know, under employment.
Mm.
So it's, you know, this is from the, you know, kind of, you know, the other angle, because, you know, how would superheroes operate in the real world? Well, it would probably be a business thing and then have PR.
Yeah,
and obviously, if you had superheroes, it would probably fuck you up in the one way or another.
Yep.
And it kind of runs with that, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Especially with the, if you're not superpowered and these, you know, these fucked up people who have superpowers fuck something up for you, then how would you react?
Yeah. Exactly.
I really enjoyed the first season, but we're waiting until, you know, the whole run, because Amazon are really annoyingly doing it on a weekly basis.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure why, because I was a little bit surprised.
They did it with Picard.
Yeah, true. But then Picard was doing weekly based on CBS All Access.
I think I personally think it's so you don't get like a month's free Prime and then just binge the whole thing and not bother.
True. I mean, I think sometimes it does feel like I go on Prime specifically to watch something that I know is there rather than to basically just kind of explore their back catalogue, as it were.
Yeah. I mean, I've had this discussion on Twitter over the weekend as well. The Amazon Prime interface is bloody awful.
Well, we've misplaced our remote for the Fire Stick. So I'm basically using my phone to tell the Fire Stick what to do now. So
with a mixture of using Alexa as well.
Shh, don't say her name.
Alexa, launch the nukes.
But, she can't hear you.
Yeah, it's something I did watch on Prime recently was Ghostbusters 2. Did you know Ghostbusters 2 was on there?
No.
Did you know that they have all the Jurassic Parks in 4K?
No.
Did you know that they have the Back to the Future trilogy in 4K as well?
Did not know that.
And neither did I until I just stumbled across something and it said, you know, related. And it's like Ghostbusters 2. And it's like, what? And then because I looked at that, it said, oh, you know, here are these other films as well. And so these are things that I might have liked to have been informed about. But yeah, it's just, oh, God. Yeah, they've got so much sci-fi channel movie crap.
Yes, yeah.
I on the front that. Page where it's like Invasion of the Spider Sharks or something like that.
But anyway, I think we'll stop this diversion. And Emily, what have you been up to?
Well, it's funny you should ask that, because something happened just as Gish was ending. Something weird.
Why don't you tell us about it, Emily?
So, like, I'd seen from some of my American pals who I follow on a fandom account that, you know, Hannibal had finally made its way onto Netflix over there in the US and Canada. Perversely, it's just coming off of Netflix in the UK. And in fact, for the past month, if you hadn't already started watching it and you searched for Hannibal on Netflix in the UK, you wouldn't come up with it there, even though it was only being removed today whilst we're recording. Doesn't matter, because I already had it on Blu-ray. But yeah, so I've watched Hannibal all the way through once. I was like, maybe I should rewatch it. And so I rewatched it. And here's the thing, I rewatched it and I realised, huh, there really is something in this whole idea of shipping Hannibal Lecter and Will Graham together. And then I watched it for a third time in quick, short succession. I was like, oh my gosh, they're totally in love. What the fuck? And that had all completely passed me by when I'd watched the series originally several years ago. I thought people were just shipping them just because it would be fun. But no, like, it's there. Brian Fuller, put it right front and centre.
Yeah, I think, you know, the most non-shippy reading that you can take of it, absolutely, the most you can do with it, is that Hannibal is obsessed with Will and Will gets obsessed with Hannibal. That's the most platonic reading that you can.
And yet the final episode. And yet that final episode, the final fucking line. The way they look at each other, it's just like, oh. Let alone the telling conversations that Will has with people like Gillian Anderson's character, Bedalia Demuria. It's like,
yeah.
Okay. Or like, how, like, people like, there was Abel Gideon, he's played by Eddie Izzard, like, clocks there's something going on a bit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, hell, even Dr. Alana Bloom, who ends up having a relationship with Hannibal after Will strikes out against her, by the end of, like, part near the end of season two, he's like, there's something going on here, but I'm the one that's sleeping with Hannibal. What? It's like, I just couldn't believe I'd missed all of this. Like, I must have just blitzed through it, like, the first time I watched it and not paid much attention, and this time I was just like, oh. Oh, God. And then I realised it's, like, the most fantastic thing ever. Because it was amazing to watch something like that and it wasn't actual queer baiting.
Yeah.
You know? It was just like, huh. Okay. So, yeah, so that happened. And because of that happening, basically, I've descended through this hole of A, rewatching Hannibal several times in, like, a month. I don't know if this is a result of the pandemic or if this would have happened naturally without a pandemic happening, by the way. So that happened. But then I was like, there's another thing that happens with the fandom. So, of course, there's loads of Hannibal fanfic out there, and I've got, like, two recs that I'll give in a bit. But here's the weird thing that happens that's also kind of cool, is that a lot of people who really like the Hannibal fandom also then like shipping characters played by Hugh Dancy, who plays Will Graham in Hannibal, and Mads Mikkelsen, who plays Hannibal in Hannibal, characters they've played in things that aren't connected, shipping those characters together.
Okay.
So, which gets referred to colloquially as the Hannibal Extended Universe.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And so, aside from the fact obviously bringing these characters in as, like, doppelgangers or twins in, like, regular Hannibal universe fic, which does happen. I haven't read any of those quite yet. But I was like, well, maybe I should rewatch some of the films, and also just watch some of the other films that they've been in, because they're in some really good films, actually. And other TV series. So I ended up, I bought digitally the first season of The Path, which was a, was it Showtime? It might have been an exclusive to Hulu originally. It had three seasons and it's got Aaron Paul in it, Hugh Dancy and a bunch of other people, but they're the main headliners. About a cult that's got, like, that's based in the US and Peru, and kind of like what happens with that. It only got three seasons, much like Hannibal. So I've been watching that, so that's been really good. I haven't bought the second season yet, probably will do soon. And then aside from that, which was obviously series, I've basically watched a whole load of films and listened to an audiobook. So, yeah. On the Hugh Dancy side of things, I have watched Adam, in which he plays a young man, or a man with, he's on the spectrum, and is, like, really into electronics and software. I've watched Hysteria, which it turns out Paul and I had seen before, but it was a long time ago, and I have a feeling I fell asleep watching it. But it was about the invention of the vibrator.
Oh, right.
So it's set in, like, the late 1800s, but it's actually about how partially kind of, you know, like, over-dramatized kind of, like, and comedic kind of story, but about how vibrators were invented, basically. I watched also Savage Grace, Savage Grace, which is available on Amazon Prime for free if you so wish to fuck yourself up. It's about what happened with the, kind of like what happened with the people who, the family of the guy that invented Bakelite. Let me just find a description and something that happened with, like, the grandson of that guy. Just come on. Come on, internet. Wait for me. Plot. Let's have the plot. So, so it's an examination. Oh, come on. Come on, Wikipedia. Gimme. So Savage Grace is a 2007 drama film by Tom Kaelin and written by Howard A. Rodman, based on the book Savage Grace by Natalie Robbins and Stephen M. L. Aronson. The story is based on the dysfunctional, allegedly incestuous relationship between heiress and socialite Barbara Daly Bakeland and her son, Anthony. The film stars Julianne Moore, Stephen Dillance, Eddie Redmayne, Elena Anya, and Hugh Dancy. And Hugh Dancy's character ends up in this very gift, but if you don't know the context, it just looks sexy. But if you know the context, it's not that sexy a gif of being in a threesome with the character, the people that play Anthony and his mum.
Yeah, context is very important in that one, then.
Yeah. It is a really fucked up film. And it is based on true events, but it's kind of like some of the families and stuff involved, like with the actual events, have like tried to stop the film existing and things and have failed. It doesn't cast anyone in a good light. Nobody gets out of that film in a good light. Anyway, so that was Hugh. Is there any other Hugh ones before I'll come back to Hugh in a minute. So then I've also rewatched the 2006 version of Casino Royale today, which is Mads Mikkelsen because he plays the chief. The
first Daniel Craig Bond film.
Yeah, the first Daniel Craig Bond film. So yeah. I didn't realise this, but it's the first Bond film where the main villain doesn't actually make it to the final act.
Oh.
Yeah. It was kind of a shame that actually Mads doesn't get to do much acting until like quite a ways into the film and near where he leaves it. Which is a shame. Weirdly, so you know how I was talking about that weird shipping situation with like Hugh Dancy and Mads Mikkelsen characters from like this extended universe thing that happens?
Yeah.
So there's this ship called, okay, so the main ship from Hannibal, which involves Will and Hannibal, is called Hanagram. Okay, we know this now. Okay, this other weird ship. Oh, wait, no, it's not this one. Okay, sorry, it's not even that one. No, it's fine. We haven't got there yet. So rewatch
Keep going.
The chief gets, and I haven't watched the other film, but it's a Hugh film, but you have to be in the right place to watch it because the chief gets shipped with a character Hugh plays in the film Shooting Dogs, which is a dramatization of events around the Rwandan genocide.
Woo!
Yeah! So, yeah, haven't quite got to reading, watching that one yet, because, that's going to be a tough one to get through. Anyway, so other mad stuff that I watched, The Necessary Death of Charlie Countryman, which is actually predominantly a Shia LaBeouf film, which happens to have Mads Mikkelsen in. Necessary Death of Charlie Countryman. Weird as hell film. Mads plays this character called Nigel, who's, like, off his fucking rocker. He swears a lot. You don't actually hear Mads Mikkelsen really swear in anything, at least not in English. Can't necessarily say the same for his Dutch films. He's really not, like, psychologically a stable one, we'd assume, as a character. Mm. Anyway, this tough, very sweary, probably a criminal, is a criminal character, Nigel, played by Mads, in The Necessary Death of Charlie Countryman, which is a weird-ass film. Like, if you watch it, you will be like, what the hell? Anyway, that character, Nigel, gets shipped with, this is where we come back, to the character of Adam, the autistic guy that Hugh plays in the film Adam.
Mm.
And that ship is called Space Dogs.
Space Dogs.
I get where the space bit comes from, because the character of Adam in Adam really likes stuff about space. I've yet to figure out where the dogs part comes from. But yeah, that's the thing. So I watched The Necessary Death of Charlie Countryman. It's an interesting film. Can I recommend it? You have to be able to tolerate Shia LaBeouf in order to watch it, which I know is like an art for a lot of people. I'm one of those people that can. But that's partly because I feel like as somebody who's the same age as me, I feel a slight kinship to him. But I always like the fact that I have never gone off the rails like he has. Fame is a fickle thing.
I was reading some stuff about, you know, things he's said or done, and he's like, oh, yeah.
Yeah. He peaked. His childhood did not help there. So I watched that. Perhaps, actually, despite how I described Savage Grace, actually, maybe the weirdest film that I've watched recently as I've gone down into essentially what was a Hannibal hole that is filled with Hugh Dancy and Mads Mikkelsen is I watched the Dutch-German film Men and Chicken, which is a Mads Mikkelsen one. And it's about these two half-brothers finding out about their familial roots. And it is not at all like what anyone would expect. And aside from the fact that Mads Mikkelsen plays a character who is compelled to go masturbate, almost at the drop of a hat, like he goes off and masturbates about as much as some people go and take shits. It's...
yeah.
Terrifying. And that's not even the worst terrifying bit, because there's actually references to bestiality in this and chimerism and stuff and genetic engineering. So in some ways perhaps even worse than Savage Grace. What I've learned is that Hugh Dancy and Mads Mikkelsen can play a range of roles. That's what I've learned in the past month. They have range.
That's definitely something that they have.
Yeah. And then coming back to Hugh, so there is a novel by the author Michael Cunningham, who wrote The Hours, which got adapted into a very successful film. He wrote a book after that called By Nightfall. It's not that long, but there's an audio version of it available, which is narrated by Hugh Dancy. The book is written in a form of first person. It's a bit like, it's like really close first person with a lot of like intertextuality and like metaphors, allegory and like referencing and shit. And basically it reads a bit like... maybe a bit like some of Virginia Woolf's stuff. I can't remember. It's been so long. But it's kind of like this really close first-person narrative. And Hugh Dancy narrates it. And it's a story about this art dealer called Peter. He goes through a midlife crisis, essentially. And certainly has like an entire crisis of sexuality as well. And he's also married. So that causes a lot of difficulty in that. And Hugh Dancy has one of those British... He's got a really nice British voice, but he also has a really nice American accent. And he uses the American accent for the narration for this. And, you know, Fran and the shipping forecast?
Yeah.
It's like that. I'm sorry. It is exactly like that. It is. If anyone wants, and it has minimal, there are erotic moments in it, but it is not erotica, because it's like, it has got stuff around sex and sexuality. It has one sex scene in it, one quite heavy-handed kiss in it. Peter is basically like becomes slightly obsessed with his brother-in-law, who's like half his age, And this causes a whole load of stuff to come tumbling out of the woodwork. But, yeah.
Sounds interesting.
Yeah. So basically, I have been circling this Hannibal-shaped hole. And it's very deep and filled with lots of things. And I haven't even finished digging yet. Mads has got a new film out, which I'm hoping to see at some point, called, in Danish it's Druk, but for English audiences it's called Another Round, which is about a history teacher and fellow teachers that decide that the only way to basically live life is to be drunk all the time. Just go through a permanent state of inebriation.
Yeah.
And it's actually been doing really well on the film festival circuit, so I'm really looking forward to seeing that at some point. So there's that.
More subtitled stuff, please.
Yeah.
Basically, if anyone from the TV and movie industry is, you know, listening, subtitles are good.
Mm. They're very good.
We want variety. Thank you.
Actually, do you know what? They should just make a TV adaptation of, or a film adaptation of By Nightfall, and just get Hugh Dancy to play Peter. He's the right age. Just get him to play the character. It's fine. Okay. Yeah. He does a perfect American accent. Oh, and I forgot to say, also been watching, gone back to watching Homeland. You would be wondering, how? That has nothing to do with Hugh Dancy and Mads Mikkelsen. Aha! It has something to do with Hugh Dancy in season 6, and I was almost at the end of season 4.
And you go,
Actually, the main character in Homeland is played by Claire Danes, who's Hugh Dancy's wife.
So I've just looked him up. He is a month younger than me. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't think he was more or less the same age. Oh well.
He's got that. He's kind of got.
Ended up myself or not?
He does have that kind of baby face thing going on, and then if he grows facial hair,
yes, he does.
He starts to look kind of menacing, depending on his mood. So yeah. Okay, and then for those people who have somehow. You end up crawling into a Hannibal-shaped hole and seeing the light of Hanagram, and want to do something about it. Rec for a season 4 fanfic, so post season 3, like an alternative season 4 fanfic, because season 4 doesn't exist. I've also read a lot about Brian Fuller, they want to make another season. And there's been a degree of interest because of how well it's been doing on Netflix in the States since it got put on there.
Yeah.
But there is a really interesting situation with the rights and stuff, basically. It gets described quite well in an interview that he and Hugh Dancy did for Collider. There's a video interview that's from, I think it's August or July this year. Basically, there's a weird situation with the rights, and it's whether or not anyone would basically let them do it. Well, so they need money, but they also need the rights holders to be like, okay, you can do it.
Yeah, I can't be the only one to think that, when I was watching it the first time around, because it was on Sky, more or less every single episode, I could not get over the fact that this was an American network TV show.
Yeah, it's like what happened with, I suppose in a way, it's almost like what happened with Ren and Stimpy for Nickelodeon. You're like, how the hell did that ever get made?
Yeah. It does not feel, even, the act sort of, pacing. You know what I mean.
Yeah.
With it doesn't feel like I'm watching a network TV series. I felt like I was watching something that could go on for as long as they wanted to.
Yeah.
And they always managed to, get it paced exactly right. But it's just, I'm still baffled as to how it got made for network and not, Netflix or...
I kind of wish the series had existed when I did a unit called Gothic and Grotesque at uni. because it is, I mean, I've also read Red Dragon, you know, in the past, but because that is the Will Graham, Tom Harris book. That's the that's the book where you do have Will Graham as one of the main characters. But like the TV series versus the films, like the TV series feels far richer. And it's also a really good example of American Gothic.
Yeah.
And that's why I wish it had been around when I did this Gothic and Grotesque unit, because, yeah, it would have been really good for that. Really good. Two thick wrecks. So long as you don't mind, you know, explicit Will and Hannibal fanfic, though the explicit takes a while in each of them to happen. It's kind of their slow burns, as the trope goes. The Shape of Me Will Always Be You is a really good post-actual series fanfic. The Shape of Me Will Always Be You, where basically Will's kind of going... It's all from Will's perspective in a sort of second first person type thing. And it's like... You're not sure how sane he is, basically, for a lot of it. And he is, like, massively pining after Hannibal. It's post the events of season 3. He's recovered, and he is pining like hell for Hannibal. And wonders if he made it, or, you know, if he'll ever come back for him and stuff. And, so there's that. And then complete AU, and it's our favourite trope, of which there is an update about that lawsuit, by the way. The episode we did about Omegaverse a while back this year. So it's an Omegaverse fic called Overcoming... I'm only partway through it. It's insane, kind of like Regency AU with Alpha, Beta, Omega dynamics. No sex has happened yet. And I'm like tens of thousands of words in. And it's just insane. Like, it's like in kind of like this sort of... it's not Regency technically. Technically it's Victorian a bit, because they're talking about trains. But it's kind of this indeterminate kind of an 1800s piece. And it's just insane. Absolutely insane. But, like, really good. Slow burn. Crazy. Speaking of the Omegaverse update, so is it Lindsay Ellis?
Mm-hmm.
A really good video in the past month about the Omegaverse lawsuit that we did that episode with Casey on. And people should go watch that if they want to get an even better look at the whole thing and to see what's happened with the case since the New York Times article that came out earlier in the year. So go watch that. And I'm just looking at my list. That is everything. I'm sorry. It's a very deep hole. They've actually both been in quite a bit. And things I've learned. Mads Mikkelsen used to be a dancer.
What?
Yeah, he was a professional dancer before he was an actor. And he still has moves. There was a GIF set and video released last week where he's doing some almost like BTS style levels of dance move. And just
what?
Sick. Moves, man. He just freaking can just... He can dance. It's insane.
Which other actor did I found out he was a dancer as well?
I know Christopher Walken.
Yeah, it's him. Yes,
he took tap for years as a kid and teen.
Yeah, the Weapon of Choice video was basically, you know, him pulling a lot of moves.
Yeah.
And he's, just, okay. Dancers, eh? Gonna have to keep an eye on them.
So that is And maybe at some point we'll have to actually do like a decent episode on Hannibal. Maybe. Just look at it. Oh, really good.
I would have to rewatch, but that wouldn't be a, you know, much of a.
It's such a terrible thing, you know, to rewatch a really good series, which apparently I don't think it ever got any like Emmys somehow.
Yeah, just.
It's just crazy.
It's like, come on.
Oh, if you are listening to this, dear listener, and you're a bit shippy like me, and you like Hannibal, and you're looking for an actual podcast to listen to, I'm just trying to... Oh, what's the handle? They're called... There's these two lovely American ladies who've been doing a podcast since earlier this year. I think they're... Are they on season two or three now? But anyway, they are called... Let me get the name. The podcast is called Hannibalism. And it is.
I see what they did there.
Yeah, and it is available on several platforms. They're up to. What season are they on? Yeah, they're still going at the minute. Yeah, so they are. Really good. They're on like Apple Podcasts. I managed to get them on Pocket Cast, so they're on everything. They're called Hannibalists on Twitter, but the podcast is called Hannibalism. So like, definitely, they use some really good analyses of the episodes. Like, really good. It is definitely well worth a listen to their show. So, yeah, that is the. that is
fell deep down that hole.
Yeah, we can go deeper sometime, but just not tonight. So yeah, I think that's everything, guys.
You managed to claw your way back up.
For now,
I'm going back.
I'm going back. Dear Lord, you know.
So basically the takeaway from this episode is that you are obsessed with Hugh Dancy and Mads Mikkelsen.
At the moment.
I'm obsessed with creating a massive D&D world full of history and continents and places and backstory and blah, blah, blah. And Retroid is obsessed with arcade boards.
And may or may not be in the process of becoming Tetsuya Iron Man.
Maybe.
Please don't.
I don't have a drill, though.
You don't have a drill?
For that reference.
Oh. Yeah, for okay. That reference. No. Hand. Okay. No.
There we go. And people go, what? Is that, yeah, just look it up.
It's October next month, guys. Like, it's a body horror film. There you go. Perfect October.
Yeah, actually, yeah.
Viewing. Perfect October viewing.
Did we see it, like, on Primal Speak as well?
It was either on.
Or was that on that horror?
Oh yeah, so I had a look at Shudder. In the past.
Which is basically kind of a horror film
streaming service,
yeah.
With a couple of its own original series type thing. Okay, I get why people in Canada and the US want to watch it because apparently over there they've got like over 650 titles. In the UK, it's 250, and for the same price in GB. So it's not good value. You can find more horror films of varying quality, like the Shudder, between Amazon and Netflix over here.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you've got Amazon or Netflix, or basically you're a horror fan to the extent where you've actually got a load of horror films.
Which we do.
It's kind of not fantastic, you know, value to basically subscribe to it.
Not in the UK.
Not in the UK. Well, we're definitely not going to get sponsored by them.
No. If they improve their catalogue over here, we would consider, but yeah, no. We're not a horror podcast. Oh, yeah, no. That was another thing.
What was another thing?
Another podcast recommendation. I know more about the
See, this is what happens. That's all we've got time for. And then...
Oh, it's me.
And then it's... Yeah.
If you can find it, guys...
I've been good.
If you can find it, guys... You have. It's because it's... King Cast It's a podcast about Stephen King novels and adaptations, and they have basically a guest on like every episode to talk about like their favorite Stephen King thing. The only reason I got onto it was because Brian Filler was a guest recently, and he talked about Salem's Lot. But they also had a few weeks back, they had, is it Alex Winter, the guy from Bill and Ted, talking about The Dead Zone, which is like my favorite Stephen King novel and film adaptation. So that's also like worth checking out, available on various things. Yeah. Okay. Honestly, that's everything. It's everything. I'm sorry. But not sorry. Really not sorry.
No, you're really not.
Not at all sorry. Zero sorry.
Zero sorry.
You're like anti-sorry.
Yeah. So that's everything, guys. So good night.
Good night. Wait, we haven't signed off properly.
And oh, goodness.
Skip that!
So it's goodbye from...
Yeah, thank you. Goodbye from me. Paul Wood, you know, the forgotten one. I'm Super Retroid on Twitter and Retroid on Eurogamer.net.
And it's me, at Paul Blewett on Twitter. And yeah, I mean, I don't usually kind of plug myself, but being denied the opportunity is just like, what the hell? What the hell,
I'm
Emily?
I'm not going to say anything about you plugging yourself. That's your business.
Emily, go for it.
It's good night for me, Emily King. I'm on Twitter at emkingma. You can find notes for this episode over at www.nerdassemble.co.uk. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Nerds Podcast. From Facebook, it's Nerds Assemble Podcast. You can listen to episodes via... Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Pocket Casts, Spotify, and probably a couple of other places where you get your podcasts. That's everything. Hopefully. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
So who are we going to get to sponsor us? Seriously. Ain't got to be Nintendo after what I said. I make no apologies.